This episode is proudly sponsored by The Helix, a new innovation district located in New Brunswick, New Jersey, the heart of the Northeast Corridor. The Helix provides a critical ecosystem for innovation by offering a range of physical environments, a vibrant community of leading innovators, and a strategic central location on the Northeast Corridor. The Helix will uniquely mix workspaces, classrooms, laboratories, venues, and collaborative environments, creating a dynamic community and setting for innovative minds. Universities, startups, Fortune 500 companies, entrepreneurs, researchers, and many others will all call the Helix home. Thus far, the Helix has assembled a community of innovative private and public organizations, such as Rutgers Health, the New Jersey Innovation Hub, RWJ Barnabas Health, Hackensack Meridian Health, universities from Ireland and Israel, and others. The Helix is where ideas will come to life. To learn more, visit helixnj.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
From NJ.com and the Star Ledger, welcome to the Rutgers Rant, your one-stop podcast for the Scarlet Knights. With your hosts, Steve Politti, and Rutgers insiders, Brian Fonseca and Pat Lenny. Let's start chopping.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Rutgers Rant. Politti and Fonseca here to talk about some Rutgers basketball, an 81-70 loss to Minnesota. Sort of takes the air out of the balloon, ends the four-game winning streak. Brian, at halftime, I texted you that this was such a what a well-played first half. I was kind of excited. Ball actually going in the basket, some offense, some up and down, some, you know, some basketball. And then it occurred to me later that that might not be the greatest pace, might be the greatest sign for the Scarlet Knights. And sure enough, the second half, Rutgers couldn't keep up offensively with Minnesota, couldn't stop them defensively. That's that.
Yeah. It's a very bad sign when Rutgers is shooting 55% and a half. Cliff Omori is 6 of 7. He has 13 points. Everything is clicking on that end. And then you look at the scoreboard and it's 37-37 and a half. Like, you felt like Rutgers could not keep doing this offensively, which sure enough, it happened. The kind of magic wore off and they shot 7.7% on threes in the second half. I think they went 3 of 13 on layups in the second half. They just couldn't buy a bucket, and their defense, which has been phenomenal during this four-game win streak, it's been unreal. It couldn't stop Minnesota. It couldn't stop their bigs. Their guards were hitting threes, and the score is even probably a little generous to lose by 11. They had the big run in the last 3 minutes to cut it down to six before ultimately falling down by 11. They were completely dominated for most of the second half, and yeah, it's a tough way, but it does make sense that it happened at Minnesota, a house of horrors where the NCAA tournament bid died last year, where 2 years ago, Minnesota was down three starters and still beat Rutgers. And it's really, they almost stole an NCAA tournament bid in 2021, if it wasn't for Jacob Young making, you know, a miracle play in overtime. So probably in hindsight, should have seen this coming, but disappointing way for the win streak to end. And now you have a pretty much do or die game at number two, Purdue, in Mackey Arena.
And Purdue coming off a lost Ohio State, which I can't imagine feels like good news for the Scarlet Knights. They're going to be angry and motivated. Tough place to play, tough matchup. I mean, obviously, Rutgers has won there, so at least they've got some confidence in that direction. But looking at this schedule now, Rutgers has a net ranking of 89, only six regular season games left. I don't know. Does it feel like you got to go 6-0, 5-1 to make this a conversation? And if you don't beat Purdue, is there still another way that you can see that this team would work itself onto the bubble?
Well, if you win the Big Ten tournament, you're into the
NCAA tournament. Of course, I understand that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, I say that facetiously. That'd be the only way they can make it, because if they lose to Purdue on Thursday, they have to run the table and go 5-0 for the rest of the regular season to be on the bubble, not to make it into the tournament, to have a chance to make it into the tournament. If you beat Purdue, you give yourself a really good chance on Selection Sunday. But if you don't beat Purdue, which I reckon they'll be double-digit underdogs, you're really kind of hoping to win every last game and praying that you make the tournament, assuming you don't win the Big Ten tournament.
Right. That gets you to, if you lose to Purdue, you run the table, it gets you to 11-9 of the Big Ten. A couple of equality, Wisconsin will still be a quality win. At Wisconsin's a quality win. At Nebraska's a quality win. But yeah, it's just this, and we were talking about this, like, you know, the committee is not going to ignore the first 20 games of the season, right? Like, we've as much as the Scarlet Knights have looked better, and they certainly have since Jeremiah came onto the court and started playing, it's not like all of a sudden they just completely erase what this team did at the start of the season. And I think that's what's going to be holding it back, you know, that's just the overall resume still does not get to that level. And we think we got a little bit ahead of ourselves. The winning streak was so good. People are excited, understandably, you know, but this is just the ebbs and flows of the college basketball season. And I think it was natural that this team was eventually going to hit one of these games like at Minnesota.
Yeah, it happens. And I think the one major thing that's still dinging them on their resume is the lack of quad one wins. They'd get two of them if they win the rest of their games, assuming not Purdue. If they lose to Purdue and win their last five, they get two more with the road games at Wisconsin and at Nebraska. But they're in danger of losing another quad one win because the road win at Maryland is just teetering on a quad one, like literally on the edge. And you'd like to think the committee would say, all right, Maryland is 76. That's close enough to a quad one win. But you don't. You really don't know.
I don't think they go that deep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know that they do that. Yeah.
And that's the one thing. And that's the one thing that winning at Purdue would help. It would be a high quad one win that takes this resume from really middling to eye-catching. So can't express enough how big this game at Mackey Arena is. If the very, 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 very slim margin they have left for error for the NCAA tournament could die if they lose at Mackey Arena.
All right, so let's talk about what they have to do to beat Purdue. Obviously, you saw Ohio State. It's possible. This is not some unbeatable team. Ohio State that just fired the coach, comes out in the first game, fired up, played really well. Two things I think that I if I'm looking for something to hang on to. I did love the fact how involved Cliff was in the first half of that game. Kind of vanished in the second half, as you mentioned. That's one thing. And all of a sudden, Rutgers is hitting free throws. That's going to be a key if you're going to win on the road at Purdue. 18 to 22 against Minnesota. I don't know if you can count on that every game, but certainly a good sign. You know, and the bad sign, of course, is just the prob 4 of 19 from 3, 24-62 overall. Jeremiah Williams, 2 of 10. You know, still these numbers, shooting the ball is still just a massive problem.
Yeah, look, they regressed to the mean against Minnesota. They were shooting over 40% on two straight games leading into it, the first time they've done that all season. And on Sunday, they kind of just shot the way they've been shooting all year, right? Like, That was also part of the win streak. They were kind of outshooting their usual numbers. And I would say that's the biggest key to winning at Purdue. Just pray that you hit an ungodly amount of threes. Pray that Purdue misses all of their threes. Pray that somehow, some way, the officials go against Purdue at Mackey Arena. Good luck with that one, when the referees were going against Minnesota at Williams Arena. And hope that Cliff Omori does what he did in the first half against Payne for an entire game against Zach Edey. And hope that Zach Edey has one off game in an entire season in that one afternoon. So essentially, everything has to go right for Rutgers to win at Mackey Arena. It's a lot to ask.
I will say this, and I tweeted this after the game, because we know Rutgers fans are just sitting there waiting to see my tweet after these games. I kid.
You apologize yet, Steve?
I'm waiting just for the right moment. I don't want people to miss my huge apology for criticizing the Scarlet Knights after losing by 16 points to Penn State at home and falling to 10-10, 2-7, 355th in offensively in the country. I want to make sure the right point to bring that up. But I did tweet this after this game that I still feel much better about this team than I did 4 weeks ago. Even after this loss, even if this turns out to be, you know, we're waiting on NIT selection Sunday to see if this team got in. Just things that they just looked better. They're like a basketball team, 16 assists. They're sharing the ball. There's some offensive flow going. They missed a lot of shots still, but they're still, that's happening. Only 8 turnovers. They forced 15. You know, even on a bad defensive day when they don't cover the perimeter, give up a lot of open looks, Minnesota shoots them out of the gym. You know, I don't know. I still feel like that the second half of the season, even if it doesn't result in what everybody wanted it to result in, gives you some sort of optimism. Do you feel that way?
Yes, for a few reasons. I think Jeremiah Williams, despite his rough offensive game against Minnesota, was still creating for his teammates. He was still giving them open shots, moving the ball, like you said, putting the offense in a flow. And I think that's very encouraging. Even in games where the shot's not falling, that happens. That's a good sign for next year. I think what Derek Simpson has been able to do as the off-ball guy next to Jeremiah Williams is also very encouraging. It felt like at times when he was, quote-unquote, the man, there was the weight of the world on his shoulders. And he's not that much more efficient, right? The numbers aren't that much better, but he looks better. He looks like he's playing more confident. It looks like, and his best, I can't remember exactly what game in the stretch, but he had one of his better games and he looked like a really good player, a much better player. And I think that bodes well for if he does stick around for next year, he could really be a strong, sixth, seventh, eighth guy off the bench that adds that spark to the backcourt that would be much needed. So that's very encouraging. And Cliff has been playing great. He's been playing great, aside from the second half where he had one shot. It's unfathomable to me that he got one shot. I didn't watch it closely enough to tell how Minnesota shifted its defense, what changed exactly. But when he's shooting 6 of 9 in the first half, when he has 13 points, when he looks dominant, I think you got to find a way to feed the big man in the post and try to let him cook. But the point stands, in the past 5 games, he's been tremendous. Whether he will be tremendous for them next year and comes back is still an open question. I still don't think he will, but some interesting comments have been made that rekindled the conversation. But I would say those 3 things to me are very encouraging and bode well for, let's be real here, they're probably going to make the NIT, and I think they'll be fired up to play in the NIT. And when you have those 3 guys playing at that level, I think you have a chance to make a run in the NIT, which is not what people want. People want the NCAA, but it could be fun.
Well, I know that you meant you teased this, and I know if I have questions about it, then the fans have questions about it. Maybe Cliff. Two words from Dylan Harper. You went to see Don Bosco play, talked to Dylan Harper afterward. He said a lot of things, and only 2 words jumped out in the course of talking about the guys he's going to be playing with next year. I imagine it was a question about Jeremiah Williams. He brings up Cliff, maybe Cliff. And I don't know. This is like, again, we're probably reading too much into it. It's always been a maybe Cliff. He's always had a year left, regardless, wishful thinking. But, you do wonder if somebody whispered that to Dylan, right? I mean, like, if he's not just pulling this out, and if he's got information that we don't have, that maybe, oh, maybe Cliff, maybe it's coming around that way. Did you read it? When he said it, did you think that, or am I reading too much into it now?
So let's be clear. The question was about Jeremiah Williams, how excited he is to play with Jeremiah next year. And he said, very excited. Me, Ace, Lathan, maybe Cliff, the sky's the limit. And he said that was the last question. We kind of wrapped up pleasantries. I said thank you to him. I said thank you to his mother, Maria. I left the locker room and went on my merry way to my car to write. And I'm transcribing. And then I hear maybe Cliff. I said, maybe Cliff. So I replayed it 7 times to make sure I heard maybe Cliff right. And he said, maybe Cliff. I think what you said is probably right. Cliff has always kind of been a maybe, even though we felt very strongly he was going to move on. The chance is always there. He does have the year. I would think that Dylan Harper does have more inside information than we do. It does feel like on the outside that there has been some momentum for Cliff just because of the way he's been playing to come back. But that's all been kind of speculation. Look, I still think there's a strong chance he doesn't come back. But if the top recruit in the following class is saying this stuff, right? I don't know. We might be just taking what something a 17-year-old said off the cuff a little too seriously, but it does. I don't know. It was interesting to hear.
The maybe in my head, if Cliff is thinking this, it's because of Dylan Harper. And I think he sees now, all right, well, the first 20 games of the year, I didn't have anybody who'd get me the ball. People were reading into it like, oh, Cliff, what's wrong with Cliff? Well, that was what's wrong with Cliff. No, with basketball. I think we know the answer to that now. Frustrating, difficult start to the season. He sees, all right, this is a showcase again for me with someone getting me the ball. And now you've got someone better who's going to be able to get him the ball. I don't know. A lot of scouts in the building. If you wanted to make the case to Cliff, you could, I guess is what I'm saying. Like, I understand he wants to go. He's not going to get drafted this year of this. If you say to him, like, look, I get it. You want to start your pro career, but, here's another year here. Here's an NBA lottery pick you're going to be passing to. Here's a guy on the wing who's going to open things up even more for you. I don't know. Is that,
There's a case to be made. There is a
Case
case to be
to
made,
be made.
and I think you can make a convincing case. But the one thing that's going to be sticking there the whole time is the fact that Cliff is getting up there in age, which is weird to say about a 23-year-old person, but in the NBA world, he's getting up there in age for a prospect, and you only have so many chances, right? So I think you have to weigh how much you could possibly improve your stock next year. You say Cliff won't get drafted this year. I agree. I'm not sure if there's anything he could do next year that would get him drafted too, right? So is it worth coming back for another year?
I only watched 2 minutes of the NBA All-Star game. I don't know that he plays the same sport as the NBA. I get that. I get it. That's just a little joke. But yeah, I mean, it's a good question about next year and going forward and beyond as well, of course. Yes.
There is a decision to be made, and I think we're talking all around the subject without asking the man Cliff himself. I'm not sure I don't know where he's at in his head, right? But I think it's an interesting question that will determine a big part of this offseason. Because if Cliff stays, that is a major piece to the puzzle
Right.
that you don't have to go into the portal for. And if he does leave, that is priority number one in the portal that you have to hit out of the park because they do not have quality depth behind him, right? I think that's very clear from what we saw yesterday. Emmanuel Ogba struggled in his 2 minutes. Antoine Wolfolk tried hard, but just could not defend a quality Big Ten five. He's just not capable of doing that. So they very clearly need at least a backup big to add, right? Maybe Lighthizer Sabo is that guy. Maybe you hope he is. But if you lose Cliff, you need a big man so desperately, or else the floor for next year and the ceiling drop.
Right. Yes. All right. So we got a bunch of that's a good transition. We got a bunch of questions about the future from the insiders. Thanks for subscribing. All right, here we go. Dylan Harper. That's the first one. What should we expect Dylan Harper to play even better than Jeremiah Williams has mostly been proving to? All right, so you've seen him a couple of times now. I think you probably have a good feel for him. What give me your takeaways first of all, and is he already the best guard in this program?
It's hard to say because I've never seen Dylan Harper play against college competition. These are grown men, as Steve Peichel likes to keep reiterating, and I think that's a fair point. Now, I think Dylan Harper has a very interesting skill set, a unique skill set that no one on this roster has. Every time I've seen him play, and this year alone, I've seen him play 6 or 7 times, he always feels like he's in control. It never looks like any defense is able to speed him up, force him to make a mistake. It always feels like he's practicing alone in the gym, has a live dribble, can kind of go fast, go slow, slow down, speed up, find open teammates, go to the tin, always seems to make the right decision. That is infinitely easier to do against admittedly slower high school athletes. He played Ramapo yesterday in the Bergen County Jamboree Final. Their best player is going to Princeton, named Peyton Seals, was guarding him all day, and there was just nothing, nothing, nothing he could do to stop Dylan Harper. I've seen Dylan Harper play against, top athletes. I've seen him play against Boogie Flan, Archbishop Stepanak. I've seen him play against Ace Bailey and McEachern. I've seen him play against those guys, and to a lesser extent, he's doing that, but it always still feels like he is one of the best players on the floor. He can always do what he wants offensively, and I think that bodes well if you could put shooters around him, if you could put Ace Bailey around him. If you can get a 3-point shooter out of the portal around him, he can both create for those guys, and then the space that they open up will allow him to really drive to the rim, finish, and he's one of the better finishers around the rim I've seen. So the one thing that Dylan Harper does not have, I'm confident in saying yet, is a 3-point shot. I think his outside shooting could use some work. That's probably true of a lot of high school players. And his defense, the motor is not always there. But again, that's always true of every high school player. They don't really play defense. They kind of just run around. And Dylan Harper, for the most part, doesn't have to do that. But yesterday, he was pretty engaged. He was walking around the whole court with Peyton Seals the whole time. And when he's locked in, he has enough athleticism and I think defensive know-how to keep up with anyone. So, yeah, look, Dylan Harper's a 5-star top three player. Every time I've seen him play, I felt like the ratings were right. So I think I'm very excited to see what he looks like at the college level. To answer the original question, I still would give Jeremiah Williams the edge only because he's going to be 22 years old next year. He's going to have 3 years of playing college basketball, and he's much more of a man than Dylan Harper.
Interesting. Okay. Yes. And I think what I was describing to someone, like if you watch highlights only, then you're like, oh my God, Ace Bailey's the better player. If you watch games only, Dylan, you think Dylan Harper's a better player. And that's just my 10 cent 30,000 feet takeaway. The few times I've seen him play, I've been really impressed. So I think he's going to be legit Legit, great. All right. Along those lines, how critical is it for Rutgers to bring in a transfer that can score if Cliff doesn't come back right now? They only have three options, and two are going to be freshmen. It's funny, I didn't, until this was the question kind of put in my head, I kind of hadn't been prioritizing that in the portal. Been looking for a big man, been looking for depth. Do you think they need a shooter?
I think so, because I think you have a great offensive weapon in Ace Bailey, and Dylan Harper is certainly capable of scoring. But you need, if you can, we say it's like it's easy, like you just go to the bargain bin at Walmart and get it. But
right,
if you
yeah.
can get a guy who can shoot threes, much like a certain Mr. Cam Spencer, who's just dominating the Big East and UConn,
oh my gosh,
if you could somehow hit the lottery with a guy like that twice in 3 years, that would be a huge boost to spread, because these guys are really good at creating offense. Imagine them creating offense in a spread out environment where the shooter is extending the defense and they have so much space to work with. So I think that's probably, in a world where we're assuming Cliff Omori is moving on, I think priority number one is a quality big man who can defend and finish well enough around the rim to replace him, and B, a shooter, a sniper, a guy who can knock down, 38, 39%, 40% of his threes, what Noah Fernandes was supposed to be like on paper when they brought him in this year. So I would certainly think that. And then depth is a question of how many people leave, right? Like earlier in the season, I think a lot of people felt Derek Simpson might be a candidate to transfer. Now that he's playing well, it feels like he might stick around. So maybe that's, you don't need a depth at guard, but maybe you need depth, at forward, because, Oscar Palmquist might be moving on. Who knows what else happens in that position. So, these things are very fluid, and we'll get a better idea after the first week or so of the portal when most of the movement happens.
Experience the Heldrich Hotel, a luxury hotel that's perfect for both the business and leisure traveler. Ideally located within minutes of Rutgers University, the Heldrich is convenient to all the action and activities at SHI Stadium, Jersey Mike's Arena, and the Rutgers University campus. The moment you walk through the doors of the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center, you know you're someplace different. A place with an independent spirit and a boutique vibe. A place where you can immerse yourself in your meeting or event as easily as you can the local culture. Located in the heart of the city, the Heldrich lets you experience all that New Brunswick has to offer. Whether you're coming to New Brunswick for a fun weekend with friends, in town for a Scarlet Knights game, or attending a business meeting, book your accommodations today at theheldrich.com.
I think Steve Pikiell thought he had added that player to his program, and we've got four questions on Gavin Griffith. And why is Griffith so disappointed in his play or the way he's being used that he will transfer out? That question, we've got a bunch. Gavin, is there a shot he doesn't like? He needs more shot discipline. Is it going? I mean, it seems like now he recognizes he's going to play 8 minutes. He better get in there and take a shot. He was 0-for-2 against Minnesota. Yeah, I mean, I just paraphrase the rest of the questions. It certainly does seem like, this is a guy who has not really developed in his first year, maybe hasn't gotten the opportunity. Certainly we saw early on defense was a problem for him. Are you a little surprised that he hasn't found a role in this team?
Yeah, look, it's harsh to say, it really is, but he's been a massive disappointment this year based on the ranking he had. So a lot of that is due to, as our colleague Jerry Carino calls it, the recruiting industrial complex, because if Gavin Griffiths was rated at 3 stars, no one would have all these expectations on him. But being a top 50 player comes with this stuff. And I have to say, yeah, it's been massively disappointing. He's been brutal offensively. He's missed 15 of his last 16 field goal attempts.
Wow.
Go through his entire game log, there's not one game that stands out after the Boston University game. That was the second game of the year where you're like, wow, he had a good offensive game. He's been brutal. And that's what he's brought in to do. He came in with the reputation of a shooter, of an offensive creator, and he's struggling on that end. And then defensively, he's been a little bit better, but it was hard to be worse than he was in the first half of the year, right? So he's not contributing anything on either end. And I have to think that he is disappointed in his play. And I wouldn't be surprised if he transferred, right? This just feels like a situation that's kind of gone bad for both sides.
I don't know. I still would be a little surprised. I didn't get the sense that they were looking for, that this was the kind of, player who was going to want to bounce around six places. He's still at a Big Ten school. Maybe after next year, if you get here, I mean, you can, it's again, like another guy you could look at, you get a Dylan Harper here, someone who can penetrate, someone who can distribute. You would think that he'd be open a lot in these circumstances. But I guess you're right. If you're not getting playing time, I can understand why he would be at a risk of transferring. Just I don't know. You really think he might jump?
Yeah, I do. I mean, he's had a horrible freshman year. And I think I'm out of the mind that the staff will give up on him, right? I don't think he's going to be given the talk or anything like that. That's not what I'm implying. But I have to think that he looks at his stats. It's hard to feel anything other than disappointed on the outside. I have to imagine how that's how they're feeling on the inside. So look, if 3 days after the portal opens, Gavin Griffith jumps in, I will not be surprised whatsoever. That's not me saying he's going to transfer. I mean, who knows? But I personally would kind of shrug my shoulders and say, makes sense.
All right, we got a bunch of random questions on fun topics, but this one we have to address. What's your take on the coaching staff changes? Obviously, promoting Scott Pallone to tight ends coach, something they had to do. Great recruiter, a guy who's been in this program forever. That was a no-brainer in a lot of ways.
We talk about retaining players a lot, how that's important to the success of the program. Retaining quality young coaches is also an important part. And Scott Vallone, from all accounts, is a rising star in the profession, great recruiter, energetic, connects well with kids and parents and coaches. And on the field is a good coach. He's been working closely with Pat Flaherty for last year. Now he's going to tight ends, which in Kirk Straka's offense is essentially an extension of the offensive line. And you have to think that Pat Flaherty's up there in age, right? Like, I don't know exactly how old he is. He's got to be what, 72, something like that. So yeah,
No, he's not in his 70s, is he? I think he's in his mid late 60s. I'll look that up while you talk.
my point being, he can't be coaching for that much longer. So I think that you put Scott Vallone at tight ends as a way to keep him on staff, give him a promotion that he deserves, make him feel like he's working upwards. And when Pat Flaherty decides to hang him up, that's an easy transition of moving from tight ends to offensive line and keeping, again, a rising star coach in your program, because the last thing you want is a guy like that to feel like he's pigeonholed as an analyst, decide to move on to another program, and then becomes a stud recruiter for them, right? So I think no brainer, great decision from Greg Schiano. Although, to be fair, I'm not sure how many options he had, given that Andy Orick got hired as the head coach of Harvard in February when most of these coaching hires are wrapped up, but still made the most of the situation. I think it's a great decision. And I think Scott Vallone has a lot of great work to do at Rutgers yet to come.
67, Pat Flaherty. So I'm guessing you're going to see another couple of years out of. He seems like the kind of guy who he's just hardwired to do this. Someone who loves being around a football team, has been around a football team his entire life. Unless he something happens, I'm guessing we're going to have Pat Flaherty on his staff for a while. Here's oh, someone asked this question. Joe at the Shore wanted to know. We need more details on your Chris Ash dinner. What else did you guys talk about? How much was the bill? Was he surprised to hear from you? Or for you, for him to respond. Great question. Yes, if people missed this, I had dinner with Chris Ash at the Super Bowl. Chris Ash obviously lives out in Vegas. He was on the Raiders staff, kind of got screwed. This is me saying this, not him saying this, by Antonio Pierce there at the end. The defense kind of the question. The defense got Antonio Pierce the job, and then he still managed to clear out a bunch of good assistants on that staff to bring in his own pals. And Chris Ash did not have a chair there. He's not going to be unemployed long, I don't think. Yeah, it was a really nice conversation. I didn't have any expectations. I texted them out of the blue. I said, "Look, I'm going to be out in Vegas. Let's get a cup of coffee and talk." We never really had that. I feel like, in some cases, when someone leaves, like you can't wait for the, like as someone in the media, sometimes when people leave a job, like you can't wait for them to go and you just never want to see them again. I don't have to tell you. I think if you're a longtime listener to this podcast, you can guess which one person I'm thinking of in particular who had a high-ranking job at Rutgers, very happy not to have that relationship anymore. Chris Ash wasn't like that. I liked him personally. I mean, it got hard at the end. You're 1-11. There's really not much we can do in the media. We cover every football game. And I even said to him during the dinner, I thought you had a chance and you lost that game to Kansas. And it was my first inkling that this was going to be tough. And it turned out to be exactly that. I was a little surprised he answered, yeah, but it turned out that the old friend of the podcast, Ryan Dunleavy, has maintained a relationship with Chris Ash, is already meeting him for dinner. I got invited to tag along with that. So it was me, Dunleavy, and Chris. It was a great conversation. A lot about the NFL. And I think that's part of, like, I get the sense that he's already a while ago sort of moved past his Rutgers experience. So most of the conversations when we were just shooting the breeze and enjoying our steaks was about the NFL and his NFL experience. And I think that's really where he wants to land if he gets his choice as to what he's going to do next. And I think he'd be, you know, right, I think he'd be a really good NFL coach. I mean, it wasn't X's and O's wasn't the problem here, right?
Yeah, I think it's very clear that he's a smart, sharp football mind. And the hard part of it was being the head coach, of being the CEO, of working up at that time money for facilities, of schmoozing with boosters, of being a people person CEO. I think that's part of the job that he struggled with. But I think if you put a whiteboard in front of him and ask him to draw up a good defensive coverage for a certain offensive game plan, he'd be great at it. So, yeah, the NFL does seem to suit him better. And the trend of current college coaches moving on to the NFL because it's a lot less work, I think Chris Ash might have been a pioneer.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's also, and he did mention this, and he said this, and I think he's also at the point where he's going to make this decision for his family, and I get the sense that, I know this for a fact, it's just a very difficult thing when you've got young kids like Chris Ash did, and he even mentioned that one of the good parts about getting fired was that he was out shopping for his daughter's 7th birthday, out buying her a bike the next day after we met. You know, he could spend time doing these things. You know, he's going to have to uproot his family again. Obviously that's not optimal. But they've got a house down in Florida in the Jacksonville area. And he told a story. I mean, it was great. He actually, and if I had heard this at the time, I'd forgotten about it in this, it was too soon at the Gator Bowl. He was down there too soon for us to talk to him. I don't think he would really want to overshadow the team being back in the bowl game. It was kind of raw at that Gator Bowl, but he was at that game. You know, he said his office was in the stadium. He walked out into a tunnel and sort of peeked his head out. He said the one person who spotted him was Fuchs, of course, which is very funny. But for the most part, you know, he kept a low profile, watched his former team. You know, I think, again, like if we're trying to revisit what happened then, it was still only 2 years. Now it's 5 years. I think he's got a different perspective on it. And he really did look good. Like I told him, like, you know, hey, you can see the 5 years on me still being around Rutgers and covering. You look younger. And he just laughed. You know, I think he does. I think there is certainly a quality of life thing in the NFL that he didn't have in the pros. I mean, sorry, didn't have in college, which is clear for a lot of guys, given what's happening around the sport. So
people are dying to know. What steakhouse you guys had? Where'd you guys?
So we went out to this. It Carl Harlow's in the suburbs, like 8 to 10 miles off the strip. Like I guess out there he doesn't. And this is true. A lot of people live in Las Vegas. He doesn't do the strip a lot. He lives out in the suburbs. A nice area, is really upscale shopping mall. Like I think Short Hills Mall kind of thing. And just a great steakhouse. I had a wonderful ribeye. It was delicious. The bill came to a couple $100 when I split it up. So that was on the expense report. Thank you, Kevin Manahan, for approving that one. So I didn't have to eat the steak and eat the bill. And then we saw, this is great. So we saw celebrities. We saw Kristen Stewart, the actress's father, was also at the restaurant. There you go.
Well, that's a bummer. I thought you were saying you saw Kristen Stewart. What,
no.
What a bury the lead. Oh, my God.
His father, yeah, her father. Yeah, we had asked the person who was with them. Anyway, is that person famous? Oh, yeah, it's Kristen Stewart's father. So, there you go. Good story. Story time with Politi's over. All right, more questions. Here's a schedule question. Is basketball entering any tournaments next year? Do you have any information on what they're going to do schedule-wise except for the constant drumbeat of schedules could be better, schedules could be good, schedules could be good?
I don't think they'll make it into a Feast Week tournament because it's probably too late. No, most of these things are kind of wrapped up at this point. And unless there's some change, like a team drops out or, you know, which is certainly possible, I don't see it. I think they'll try to play some non-conference games away from home, maybe at Madison Square Garden, maybe at the Prudential Center. I'm sure they'll play a Big Ten game at Madison Square Garden. Like they didn't do it this year, but they did it last year with Michigan State. That wouldn't surprise me. I do think I've heard that the schedule will be better. The schedule should be better. There's really no excuse for it not to be better, or at the very least at the level that it was this year. But I have no details at this time. Those things are kind of getting ironed out as we speak, and we'll see. But yes, it has to be better.
We're just hearing things like at Duke, Gonzaga, like all these, and then you end up with Central Connecticut. You know, they can't do that again.
Yes. Yes, the Duke game at Madison Square Garden does not appear to be happening, which I know was floated around on the message boards. I don't know that for a fact. It just seems like it's not going to happen, but it would be great. I think Cooper Flagg against Dylan Harper and Ace Bailey at Madison Square Garden would be a spectacle if it does happen.
You mean to tell me something on the message boards was wrong? Is that what you're telling me? Oh, never
There
have
are
guessed
power
that.
users on the message boards that have information every once in a while, but this one was case number 99 out of 100 where they were wrong.
Myself into a coffee fit. All right, more questions. Empty seats. When I watch a lot of Big Ten basketball games on TV, there are some arenas that have a lot of empty seats. Is it me or is that true? Or does the attendance seem down with some schools like Iowa and Maryland? Well, certainly Maryland. Ton of empty seats. Ohio State, ton of empty seats. I think there's just some, seem that there are some schools that just have them and some that, but I've read a story. Iowa's done another one, right? Iowa, comparatively to the Caitlin Clark experience, the men's basketball team struggling with attendance. So yeah, there are a good number of them.
I was having a men's basketball attendance crisis of apathy. Scott Docterman of The Athletic did a really good job of writing a story about that, which I also read. It was really good. But there's other cases like Ohio State is never going to fill that place out because there's 20,000 seats. It is impossible to sell that out for a college basketball game unless it's Ohio State of the early aughts where they're going to Final Fours and they're ranked in the top five. It's just not going to happen. Williams Arena is a pretty big arena too. I think Rutgers benefits from having the smallest arena in the Big Ten and one of the smaller arenas in college basketball at 8,000. I think that's a perfect number for college
Perfect
basketball
number.
because that's like just enough that you can fill it out and there's still interest for more. Because if you made the rack 10,000, there might be half the games that just don't sell out, right? Like,
Yeah, 10. I think they could do 10. If you get to like 13 or 14, it would be.
which a lot of these places are, right? Again,
Yeah.
Ohio State is 18 or 20, something like that. Michigan might be up there with 13. Michigan State, I think, is a little cozier. But the point being that most Big Ten arenas are like that, which is why a lot of them have a lot of empty seats. Maryland, I can't really explain. That place was an absolute ghost town, but that game was at 6:30 on a Tuesday, so.
All right, finally, random question. I love the random questions. Where is the real Scarlet Knight at basketball games? The one that rides the horse at football games? Did they give him the chop? I don't ever remember the real Scarlet Knight being at basketball games. And this is going back to, early days here. I just think he that's a football thing, right?
I've never seen him at the rack, as far as I can
Never.
remember.
And I'm gonna rip the real Scarlet Knight. Here you go. This is a good one. I'm not a big fan. I'm not a big fan of the actual Scarlet Knight. I like the mascot. That's what a mascot's supposed to look like. I don't need another mask. I don't need the horse. And this is when I watched it when I was in the crowd for the game. I came away with a lot of these little observations. But like I didn't need the horse really anymore. I feel like, okay, here's a horse. And the horse goes away. I don't know. I didn't need the cannon. There's just certain things you're like, all right, they've been doing it forever, and they just kept on adding more things, never took anything away. So if I were to, I'd give the real give the knight a chop. That's it. Fire the knight. That'd be a good column, right? In the middle of August, Politicon. Knight must go. What do you think? You
Just be
reading that?
classic. It would be
You
classic
clicking
you,
on that?
classic NJ.com. But so I'm all about it. And as I'm a minimalist when it comes to crowd and game day experience. I think the programs and the professional teams and everyone should do less. There should be no music playing as the offensive team has the ball, as the home team has the ball in the NBA. There should be no music so loud that my eardrums are going to burst during a media timeout at the rack. There should be nothing. There should be fans making noise themselves. There should be organic excitement, not this pumped up corporate kind of just like forcing you to have a good time deal that they do at these arenas. Maybe I'm different from a lot of fans, but if I was going to a game and I had to deal with all that, it would make me want to just sit at home on my couch and watch the game with a better view and a lot less nonsense happening all around me. Let the fans chant. Let the fans do all their fun stuff. That's what makes sports good, not this, make some noise nonsense.
There's not a real Spartan, right? There's not a real Badger. There's not a
Buckeye.
real Align that line. Well, there was a real Illini, but he got canceled for good reasons. There's not a real. I mean, think about this. There's not a real. Yeah, Nittany Lion. There's just a guy in a costume. There's not a. You don't need two.
And in basketball, it's a little different, right? Like Texas isn't bringing Bevo, a huge live cow, to the middle of the basketball arena, right? Or is Georgia bringing Uga to the basketball arena? I don't think so.
Probably, I think so. Yeah, I'll go everywhere. He's like a little dog. I think I'll go.
Well, Butler does
Right,
because
Uga's not a
Butler
basketball.
football is basketball, right?
Right.
I don't think Uga does for Georgia.
Really? Huh. A little surprised. Okay.
I could be wrong. There's no Crimson Tide. You don't see Nick Saban coming out with a giant elephant.
There's not a real elephant. There's just an elephant. There's one elephant. We take that far enough yet? Probably. What else do we got? We got baseball off to a good start, I saw. Lacrosse lost. Wrestling beat Maryland.
Good start for baseball, sweeping Winthrop at Rock Hill, South Carolina. Bit of a change from the usual Miami opening series. They go to Winthrop, which is a good program, and they won. Men's Lacs had a setback against a team that's ranked higher than, to be fair, in Army, but it's their first loss of the season. And wrestling gets a key dual meet win over Maryland as the Big Ten tournament kind of comes up. And I think, as disappointed as the fans have been about another year without a signature win in the dual meet season, there's always a chance to make up for that in the Big Ten tournament and NCAA tournament season. So that is coming closer and closer. And the winter sports are wrapping up, Steve. We got six basketball games left, and it's almost time to do some portal watching and spring football watching.
And I'm going to break news on the podcast. You are going to West Lafayette. You're going to Mackey. This is how big this game is. We are traveling to the heartland. It's going to be a first time at Mackey, I assume, right? You haven't gone there before.
I've never gone, and looking forward to it. The mecca of Big Ten basketball. Looking forward to hearing what it's all about. And I know it's been compared to the RAC as two of the better atmospheres in the Big Ten. And I will have a first person view of which is better.
There's not a real Boilermaker. There's just piss. There's just Pete. There's not like another Boilermaker, right?
You're right. No train on the tracks.
Let's share the checks. All right. On that note, let's sign off here. We'll be back to hear all about Fonseca's travels. I want you to, and I really do want you to go deep. I've not been to West Lafayette myself. I would like the entire scouting report. Hope you spend some time, get dinner in West Lafayette, experience the Lafayette experience as too much as you can. Let me know how that is. Where I expect good answers to that in the next podcast. And we'll be back to talk about the basketball game, which kind of the rest of the season hinges on. So thanks for listening. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Rutgers Rant. To participate in the conversation and receive live updates about the Scarlet Knights directly to your phone, sign up at nj.com/insider.